abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It is Thursday, February 6th, 2014. Part two of our discussion with Peter Klein about Karl Marx and Rolling Stone magazine, which claims that Marx was right about many of the phenomena we're observing in the year 2014. And on yesterday's program, we got through two out of the five alleged areas in which Marx was right. And we're going to get through the other three today. It gets really juicy today. So I'm going to welcome back to the program now Peter Klein. You'll recall that Peter is the Karl Menger Research Fellow at the Mises Institute, Mises.org, M-I-S-E-S.org is the website for the Mises Institute. Peter's also a professor at the University of Missouri. He's the author of numerous books, and he holds a PhD in economics, if you can believe it, from the University of California at Berkeley, where he emerged with his sanity intact. All right, Peter, welcome back to the program.
Thanks. Great to be here again.
All right, we're going to pick up where we left off, and then eventually I'll make a YouTube out of our conversation, and I'll just combine the two episodes together so people can just hear it all at once. But the podcast listeners who subscribe to this program, they probably were tossing and turning all last night, you know, in anticipation of this program. When am I going
to
get
to hear the ending?
Exactly, right. When am I going to get the refutation of the rest of this thing? Well, wait no longer. Here we go. So, as I said at the beginning, to remind people or people who missed yesterday, we're continuing on in our discussion of an article in Rolling Stone claiming that Karl Marx sort of anticipated a lot of the phenomena that we're observing here in 2014. We're trying to see if that's true or not, and whether these claims by Marx are true, et cetera, et cetera. So I want to pick up right where we left off. And if you missed yesterday's program, don't feel like if you're driving your car, you got to turn this one off. This one, you can start with this one and then listen to the other one later. So we're on number three out of five. Number three says the IMF, parentheses, the globalization of capitalism. So we read the following. I'm going to read the paragraph, then we'll comment on it. And of course, again, it assumes that the IMF is part of capitalism. The IMF is funded by governments. So by definition, it's not part of the nexus of voluntary exchange. So again, we just have a category mistake here. So we read this. Marx's ideas about overproduction led him to predict what is now called globalization, the spread of capitalism across the planet in search of new markets. And he quotes Marx as saying, the need of a constantly expanding market for its products chases the bourgeoisie over the entire surface of the globe. It must nestle everywhere, settle everywhere, establish connections everywhere, unquote. While this may seem like an obvious point now, Marx wrote those words in 1848 when globalization was over a century away. And he wasn't just right about what ended up happening in the late 20th century. He was right about why it happened. The relentless search for new markets and cheap labor, as well as the incessant demand for more natural resources, are beasts that demand constant feeding. Now, we'll leave out the IMF because he's just using that as a catch-all phrase because each one of these points he has a cutesy little title for. So he thinks IMF embodies...
He thinks his readers will bristle at IMF.
Yeah, right. Yeah. They don't really know what it is, but it's probably pretty bad. And, of course, the International Monetary Fund, the monetary aspect of the Monetary Fund, is all based on money that is government-supplied. Like, there's nothing capitalistic about it other than it involves money. So they feel like, well, that I know capitalism has money. Like, my Monopoly board game has a lot of money in it, so this must be capitalism. All right, forget the IMF, though, because he doesn't really mention the IMF. What's the deal here? How would you evaluate? I mean, you especially, somebody who talks a lot about the firm, industrial organization, et cetera. What's your reaction to what I just read?
Yeah, it's so funny on a number of levels. I mean, first, the idea that Marx was really prescient in 1848 by explaining that the trade occurs across international boundaries, you know, the idea that that's somehow novel would shock people of the 16th and 17th and 18th centuries, you know, Adam Smith and David Ricardo, and of course anyone familiar with international trade, which, you know, had been going on for a couple of centuries, at least, before Marx was writing. So, I mean, there's certainly nothing particularly insightful about this idea. But what's funny is, you know, think about the way Marx puts it. I mean, imagine that you're an impoverished consumer at some remote part of the world in sub-Saharan Africa or Eastern Europe or the Americas, right? And all of a sudden, here come ships loaded with goods from another place that are available for you to trade, things that you could not get in, or you could not produce or obtain in any way in your home region, and you can take goods that you can produce efficiently and effectively, and you can exchange them with people far away for goods that they produce efficiently and effectively, and you can realize these gains from trade. You know, the principle of comparative advantage developed by Ricardo in the 18-teens and so forth. To Marx, this is like an invasion, right? It's like if a ship pulled up on shore and they open up the holds, and instead of armies coming out, there are merchants coming out with goods and services they want to offer, you know, to me in exchange. You know, this is like the plague to Marx. This is like a horrible military conquest. Of course, global trade makes people better off. As Adam Smith and David Ricardo and their predecessors and their followers all perfectly well understood, and Marx did not, this idea that globalization represents sort of conquest by imperialistic firms that are, you know, acquiring new territories and compelling people to trade with them, of course, is absolutely ludicrous. Now, it should be said that many of the large trading firms of Marx's day were government-connected monopolies. Marx would, of course, wanted all trading to be conducted by government-controlled monopolies. But, of course, this is a very small fraction of globalization, you know, sort of global trade as a whole. So, I mean, there's just nothing in here at all that has anything to do with international markets, with global exchanges of labor and goods. You know, those are all for the good. Those all make people better off, and not just in a trivial sort of academic way, but, you know, many people who would otherwise have died of mass starvation in the developing world have survived and indeed prospered, and their standards of living have increased rapidly precisely because of this thing, globalization, that is such anathema to Marxists and other, you know, left-wing critics of capitalism.
And of course, Marx always uses kind of military imagery, as you say, to refer to normal market exchange, and it leaves the reader with the impression that something sinister is going on here, that capitalism
right.
just irrationally drives people to go all over the world doing their sinister work. But when you peel away the crazy rhetoric and you just try to think about it normally, what's actually going on is that there are a lot of people in the world and they have a lot of needs. And we have to think of new and more efficient and less costly
yeah.
ways of meeting those needs. Yeah. Like, that's really what's happening. That's all.
That's right. Look at Marx's wording. The need of a constantly expanding market for its products chases the bourgeoisie over the entire surface of the globe. It must nestle everywhere, settle everywhere, establish connections everywhere. I mean, that sounds horrible.
Yeah.
It's like an octopus.
It's an octopus, right.
You know,
yeah.
Grabbing people and squeezing them. Of course, this is, you know, it's almost like philanthropy. I mean, these are these capitalists are going around the world offering to make people's lives better. And, you know, that's a horrible thing to Marx.
And, of course, what would a modern company be doing? I mean, let's say, like, I don't know, 85% of modern companies. Who's their natural target audience? Whom are they appealing
yeah.
to? The mass market. I mean, almost
that's
every
right.
firm is trying to produce things for the general public. So
that's
they're
right.
trying to think of ways to satisfy not the desires of Queen so-and-so who wants a new diamond necklace, but they're trying to satisfy somebody who wants a toaster or somebody who just wants to improve his life in some way
exactly.
that doesn't impress a Cambridge Marxist professor, but will, in fact, you know, marginally improve the standard of living of an average person.
Oh, that's absolutely right. I mean, the elites always do well under any system of social organization, including communism. It's the masses who have the most to gain in relative terms from capitalism as opposed to socialism. And, you know, just to sort of segue into point number four about Walmart, Walmart is, it's supposed to be a dirty word. When a Marxist hears Walmart, you know, his ears sort of prick up right away. But just as you said, Walmart, the greatest beneficiary of Walmart is not some wealthy, you know, shareholders. It's the consumers of Walmart. I mean, Walmart is a store that caters to low-income consumers, that employs low-skill, relatively low-skilled individuals. I mean, Walmart is the greatest, you know, benefactor of the least well-off people in America, you know, of any major corporation, but you wouldn't expect the Marxists to understand that or to appreciate it.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, Walmart has taken a vast network of distribution of goods and broken it up into a bunch of different occupations that a lot of average people can perform because it's been so well mechanized that somebody who couldn't possibly conceive of the problems at stake can press a few buttons and play an important role in this overall structure. And the complaint is these people aren't being paid enough. If there were somebody out there who thought this person could better serve the public in my firm, they would have been hired by that firm. If Walmart is hiring them at all, it means this is the only person that thought my labor is worth something. Why would that be the outfit that you would be critical of? Why aren't you critical of all the firms that didn't hire these people at all? I know that's not the point of the article, but I always wondered about that. Why is the one outfit that gets criticized the outfit that actually employed the person and not all the other greedy outfits that are paying them $0 an hour?
Yeah. Again, it's snobbery. It's a patronizing attitude. Most of these writers, the people who are, you know, they're writing from New York City or, you know, L.A., they've never even been to a Walmart, much less, you know, right, have regularly depended on a Walmart for their goods and services. I mean, they're snobs. They're elitists. And, of course, my gosh, this company is headquartered in Arkansas. I mean, how much more sort of, you know, socially irresponsible can you be? They don't even have a good dinner theater, you know, and near Walmart's headquarters. I think it's pure elitism and snobbery and a failure to recognize that companies like Walmart are huge benefactors of the least well-off. And by the way, you know, what the author's trying to argue here is somehow that the existence of Walmart validates Marx's prediction that capitalism would come to be dominated by these sort of big monopoly firms. I mean, that in itself is, again, it's just a completely invented assertion. Yeah, I mean, there are lots of big companies like Walmart. Walmart has a large market capitalization. It's made very effective use of economies of scale. You know, Microsoft is a large corporation. General Motors is a large corporation. There are lots of large corporations in the U.S., but and around the world. But overall, there has been absolutely no increase in sort of average rates of concentration since Marx's time. In many industries, in many cases, industries are much less concentrated than they were in Marx's day. They're more competitive, using that term in sort of the conventional sense of having, you know, lots of firms doing different things and experimenting and so forth. So again, this is just, you know, I mean, there's so many fallacies here, it's hard to pick them out, but this is just sort of arguing by anecdote. I mean, yes, there is a large company. Somehow that is supposed to validate Marx's idea, quote, that market power would actually be centralized in large monopoly firms as businesses increasingly preyed upon each other. I mean, that just doesn't correspond to reality in any way.
Well, let me read the sentence in here that really, in point number four, that really gets to the heart of his claim. He says, today, mom-and-pop shops have been replaced by monolithic big-box stores like Walmart. Small community banks have been replaced by global banks like J.P. Morgan Chase, although obviously that has nothing to do with capitalism because the whole banking system is a cartel structure under the Federal Reserve, which is a creation of Congress, and the money is all is supported by legal tender. It's monopolistic through and through. It's a cartel. It's nothing like the free market. And then small farmers have been replaced by the likes of Archer Daniels Midland. Well, I mean, there are aspects of that story where I think there are ways that that agriculture subsidies may have contributed to that. But
that's
right. I think these are, though, I mean, I know you say this is anecdotal, but this is what a lot of people come face to face with every day. These are things people see. Now, what you may be talking about is going to sound very surprising to people that, in fact, average concentration rates are no higher than before. But people aren't likely going to come across that because you'd have to read a scholarly article in a journal somewhere, an obscure source, even to be aware of it.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. But, I mean, I think it's easier for people to understand it this way. I mean, suppose you live in a community where, you know, on your grandparents' day or your parents' day, there were, you know, 25 little mom-and-pop shops downtown, and now most of them are boarded up and because there, you know, there's a Walmart and a Best Buy and a Home Depot on the periphery of town. I mean, so if you're only looking within the geographic constraints of your little town, it may very well be that there are a small number of big box stores and you know all these other mom and pop stores aren't there anymore. But there's two ways in which that's the wrong way to measure competition, right? I mean, the total amount of goods and services that are available to you would be vastly higher in that case than what you get in the mom and pops. It's not that the Walmarts and the Best Buys are simply displacing the mom and pops in cases like that, but they're offering vastly more goods and services than the mom and pops collectively offered before the big box stores came about. The second point is, have these people never heard of something called the Internet?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, capitalism, globalization, the fact that even if you live in a small town and there's only one store, you know, within a 25-mile radius, if you have access to the Internet and there are streets, you know, that a UPS truck can drive upon, you have, you know, you have the whole, a huge, you know, a set of, you know, global companies at your fingertips, just a few clicks away. So measured that way, things are much more competitive than they ever were in Marx's day.
Right. And not only do you have giant companies at your fingertips, you have a huge array of tiny little companies at your fingertips.
Exactly.
On the Internet. And in particular, a lot of those are fostered by a major corporation like Amazon, through
exactly.
its Amazon Marketplace. And it's as if none of these things exist at all, according to this article. And incidentally,
yeah.
you know, Peter, you get the sense when you hear criticisms like this that anybody who makes the argument, as you and I do, that the array of consumer goods is vastly greater and there's a more diverse array of consumer goods, that people who say this are really just stupid, materialistic dolts who don't understand that there are things more important in life than your crummy consumer goods. So let me translate that into something that maybe people can appreciate more vividly. My own wife grew up extremely poor. I mean, her family was poor to a degree that most people can't imagine, and it meant something that they could go to Walmart and get inexpensive children's clothing. I mean, literally, so they could clothe their
yeah.
children. You know what? That is not just, well, I need to have the most recent frippery in order to satisfy my desire for conspicuous consumption.
That's
no,
right.
This was a real, living, breathing family whose standard of living was vastly improved because they weren't being ripped off every time they wanted to buy a onesie for an infant.
Yeah, that's right. Now, there's a lot of this sort of phony nostalgia about, oh, you know, walking into the old hardware store and being able to chat up the proprietor, and he'd ask you, how's your mother-in-law doing, and so forth. I mean, two things to note about that. First of all, in most cases, those mom-and-pop stores were charging very high prices compared with what you would pay now, and lots of people simply could not afford to patronize those mom-and-pops. And yeah, if you were relatively well-to-do, you could stroll down the main street and have a cup of tea and chit-chat with the butcher and so forth, but that was not in the interest of the community as a whole. And the second point is, you know, there's nothing at all in a free market system that says people can't have little main streets and they can't have small artisan shops. The point is you have to pay for it. It has to be priced out. Right? If people are willing to pay higher prices for that kind of shopping experience, then by all means, there will be plenty of entrepreneurs willing to provide little shops like that. And of course, we see those. There are lots of, I mean, you know, artisan bakeries and butcher shops and organic restaurants and so on are flourishing as never before as, you know, supply chains have become more efficient. You can order off the Internet. It's a lot easier to provide those kinds of things than it was before. So the fact that Walmart sets up somewhere, you know, nearby by no means prevents people who are willing to pay for it to have whatever kind of cutesy and fun shopping experience they desire.
All right, let's jump to point number five, low wages, big profits, parentheses, the reserve army of industrial labor. Again, I'm going to just read the paragraph and then get your comments. So we read this. Marx believed that wages would be held down by a reserve army of labor, which he explained simply using classical economic techniques. Capitalists wish to pay as little as possible for labor, and this is easiest to do when there are too many workers floating around. Thus, after a recession, using a Marxist analysis, we would predict that high unemployment would keep wages stagnant as profits soared, because workers are too scared of unemployment to quit their terrible, exploitative jobs. And what do you know? No less an authority than the Wall Street Journal warns, quote, "Lately, the U.S. recovery has been displaying some Marxian traits. Corporate profits are on a tear, and rising productivity has allowed companies to grow without doing much to reduce the vast ranks of the unemployed," unquote. That's because workers are terrified to leave their jobs and therefore lack bargaining power. It's no surprise that the best time for equitable growth is during times of full employment, when unemployment is low and workers can threaten to take another job. Okay, what's your response to that?
You know, it's hard to know what to say to that. There's so many things one could note. I mean, first you might say, okay, if it is true as the author states that quote, capitalists wish to pay as little as possible for labor, and this is easiest to do when there are too many workers floating around, then how did we ever get a boom in the first place? I mean, a recession means conditions have gotten worse from they were in a previous period of higher employment. I mean, is it that capitalists, you know, they wanted to pay workers higher wages, and so they had higher incomes and more to spend, and this led to some kind of general prosperity, and then all of a sudden employers changed their minds and decided they wanted to get greedy and wanted to start paying workers less? I mean, how do you get a business cycle out of this kind of analysis? I mean, that's point number one. I mean, point number two, this whole idea of the reserve army of the unemployed, again, it's just a complete fabrication of Marx's imagination. I mean, there's no sort of, Marx doesn't have any theory of what determines wages. I mean, if it's the truth that, Marx thinks that wages are determined by some sort of, you know, coercive bargaining between wealthy, powerful capitalists and poor and sort of unorganized workers. But again, then why would wages rise and fall over time? How do you explain differences in wages across industries? How do you explain the fact that, you know, workers with more skills and more education earn higher wages than similar workers with fewer skills and less education and experience, even if they belong to the same union or work in the same industry? I mean, there's nothing in Marx's analysis that can explain anything of any sort of actual patterns of wage profiles over time or across worker types or across industries or whatever. Again, as we said before, Marx rejected any sort of micro foundations of his kind of analysis, so he would reject the notion, the contemporary correct notion, right, that wages are determined by marginal productivity. And so, you know, Marx has nothing else to use to explain wages that he personally thinks are too low, so he invents this notion of the reserve army of the unemployed and the greedy capitalists who are refusing to pay their workers what they deserve, or unions that aren't powerful enough, or whatever. Again, there's no theory of earnings in here whatsoever, no theory of wages, and certainly no theory of recessions.
So, having looked at all five of these things, what do you think is the greatest, most common misconception about the market that we've seen in here that you think the general public has, that if we could overturn it, it would go a long way to tumbling all the other misconceptions?
Yeah, I mean, maybe the most obvious kind of general fallacy that Marx adhered to was this notion that we can explain economic outcomes in terms of relationships among these broad and sort of static categories of individuals, right? Labor versus capital. Financiers versus assembly line workers and this sort of thing. I mean, you know, that isn't how an economy works, right? This sort of crude aggregationist fallacies. And especially in a modern economy, you know, we were talking about Walmart earlier. Well, the workers of Walmart, you know, wage-earning individuals, they're part of labor, I guess, right? I mean, the management at Walmart, most of these people are on wages and salaries. They're also part of labor. I mean, the earnings of Walmart do not go into the hands of the few oligarchs, right? I mean, the profits that Walmart earns are paid out to Walmart shareholders as dividends. And who are the shareholders of Walmart? Well, you and me, right? I mean, corporate stock ownership has never been as widely dispersed as it is today in the United States. Most ordinary working people that have any kind of retirement savings, 401ks, whatever. I mean, they're the capitalists who are getting the money from Walmart. So the laborers, the managers, the capitalists, the investors, and in many senses, the entrepreneurs. These are all the same people. All people perform multiple functional roles in the economy, and over time throughout their lives, they may, you know, perform predominantly one and then predominantly another. There's lots of mobility horizontally and vertically in a modern capitalist industrial economy. So the idea that, you know, at birth, you're born into some sort of rigid caste, you know, I guess maybe this is, you know, reflects Marx's you know, his environment in 19th century Britain, and he really thought there was this kind of rigid class system, which doesn't have anything to do with a market economy, theoretically or empirically.
Peter, I'm going to let you go at this point. You've been extremely generous with your time of being here for two programs to talk about these points. But even though Marxism as a system is probably dead, the fallacies live on, and they live on and they burn in the hearts of people who I think just love to show how much better and smarter they are than everybody else. Because, look, you all think this guy was a stupid head, but that's just because you're too stupid to see all the nuggets of wisdom in him. And I think we took care of this guy pretty nicely in the last couple of programs, thanks to you. So thanks for being here.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to be with you, Tom.
All right, everybody, that was Peter Klein. I hope you guys will check out and support the Mises Institute, Mises.org. Make sure and subscribe to this program via iTunes or Stitcher. We release a new program every weekday, Monday through Friday, via those means, and you can subscribe very easily via the links that you'll find at TomWoodsRadio.com. And you can hear the program streaming for the first time every weekday at TomWoodsRadio.com at noon Eastern. Tomorrow on this program, it's Mike Church of The Mike Church Show on Sirius XM, a real hero of mine, a great guy, and you'll love hearing from him, I know. And please remember, you are helping me pay the bills here at The Tom Woods Show at no cost to yourself every time you make an Amazon purchase by first entering Amazon via the Amazon widget you will see at TomWoodsRadio.com. Just make sure you don't have an ad blocker or you won't see it. But just head over to TomWoodsRadio.com, enter Amazon from there, and you are helping me out, and I really, really appreciate that. Hope you guys are enjoying the program. We'll see you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.